Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world, here on WSCA LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, June 4th, 2005. Here's what we have coming up. We'll begin with news with Jeff White, followed by selections from the May 2005 National Conference on Media Reform's opening speakers. Our second hour will begin with local announcements, bring you news from New Hampshire activists, and the latest episode of Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. First, we begin with some news.
Good afternoon and welcome to an amazingly beautiful weekend in New England. And here is some news for Making Waves. This story from the Associated Press. Iraq's security services has suffered their deadliest month since the fall of Saddam Hussein, illustrating the rise in violence in the country. This announcement by the Interior Ministry gives the lie to suggestions that better intelligence and more arrests have reduced the insurgents' capability to strike. Officials reported that at least 220 police officers and soldiers were killed in May, mainly by suicide bombings. The figure does not include potential recruits killed while queuing up to join the forces, a favorite target. This figure does not even include those killed in the last two or three days, a senior police officer said. March was the previous deadliest month, with 200 security personnel killed. Nearly 500 civilians were killed in the past month, and U.S. forces also suffered badly, with 77 military deaths, the highest toll since January. The insurgents seem to be improving the sophistication of their attacks, the ministry said yesterday, in that one insurgent posing as a fruit vendor who had sold poisoned watermelons to police officers manning checkpoints on one of the main roads from Baghdad to the north. At least one policeman died. This story from Fox News. Yes, I said Fox News. I really said that. The British government has a memo that critics say proves the Bush administration manipulated evidence about weapons of mass destruction in order to carry out a plan to overthrow Saddam Hussein. This has received little attention in the U.S. mainstream media, which has frustrated opponents of the Iraq war. The Downing Street memo, first published in the Sunday Times of London on May 1st, summarizes a high-level meeting between Prime Minister Tony Blair and his senior national security team on July 23, 2002, more than 8 months, yes, that's 8 months, before the March 2003 coalition invasion of Iraq. And I use the word coalition loosely. The memo suggests that British intelligence analysts were concerned that the Bush administration was marching toward war on shaky evidence that Saddam posed a serious threat to the world. In the memo, written by top Blair aide Matthew Rycroft, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw indicated in the meeting that it seemed clear Bush had already decided to take military action. But the case was thin, read the memo on Straw's impressions. Saddam was not threatening his neighbors, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, Iran, or the United States, for that matter. The memo was also paraphrased former head of the British Secret Intelligence Services, Richard Dearlove, fresh from meetings in the United States. The memo said Dearlove believed military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam Hussein through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, the memo reads. But the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy, according to Dearlove's impressions. The National Security Council had no patience with the UN route and no enthusiasm for publishing material on Iraqi regime record. There was little discussion in Washington of the aftermath after military action, hence the current mess. The memo, which received sporadic reporting in major newspapers in the United States throughout May, has sparked an outcry from more than 88 Democratic members of Congress who have signed two letters to President Bush demanding a response. Led by Representative John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, the signatories are mostly representatives who oppose the war in Iraq and make up the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Conyers says the mainstream media have ignored the story and let President Bush off the hook. He noted that liberal blogs and alternative media have been keeping the story alive, but these voices are too few and too diffuse to overcome the blatant biases of our cable channels and the negligence and neglect of our major newspapers, Conyers said in a recent statement. White House spokesman Scott McClellan has said there is no need to respond to the memos. Go figure. The authenticity of which has not been denied. Dante Zappella does not agree. For Zappella, the Downing Street memo strikes a critical and personal chord. His brother, Sergeant Sherwood Baker, 30 years old, a soldier in the Pennsylvania National Guard, was killed in Baghdad 13 months ago on what Zappella said was a mission to find weapons there. My family knows the consequences of the decision they made to go to war, said Zappella, 29 years old, of Philadelphia. He is a member of the military family Speak Out, a group that opposes the war, and according to Zappella, now has more than 2,000 members. Zappella argues that someone has to be made accountable for the lives lost on false pretenses. The goal was always to invade Iraq, whatever obstacles, legal and moral, were in our way, he said. I feel that we deserve an amount of accountability by our officials for the decisions they make. This story, also from the Associated Press. They fed them well. The Pakistani tribesmen slaughtered the sheep in honor of their guest. Arabs and Chinese Muslims famished from fleeing U.S. bombing in the Afghan mountains. But their host had ulterior motives to sell them to the Americans, said the men who are now prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. Bounties ranged from $3,000 to $25,000. The detainees testified during military tribunals, according to transcripts the U.S. government gave the Associated Press to comply with the Freedom of Information lawsuit. A former CIA intelligence officer who helped lead the search for Osama bin Laden told AP the account sounded legitimate because U.S. allies regularly got money to help catch Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters. Gary Shronin said he took a suitcase of $3 million in cash into Afghanistan himself to help supply and win over warlords to fight for U.S. special forces. The U.S. Departments of Defense, Justice, and State, as well as the Central Intelligence Agency, said they were unaware of the bounty payments made for random prisoners. Isn't that special? But a wide variety of detainees at the U.S. lockup at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, alleged they were sold into capture. Their names and other identifying information were blacked out in the transcripts from the tribunals, which were held to determine whether prisoners were correctly classified as enemy combatants. One detainee who said he was an Afghan refugee in Pakistan accused the country's intelligence service of trumping up evidence against him to get bounty money over from the U.S. When I was in jail, they said I needed to pay them money, and if I didn't pay them, they'd make up wrong accusations about me and sell me to the Americans, and I'd definitely go to Cuba, he told the tribunal. After that, I was held for 2 months and 20 days in their detention. Another prisoner said he was on his way to Germany in 2001 when he was captured and sold for a briefcase full of money, then flown to Afghanistan before being sent to Guantanamo. It's obvious. They knew Americans were looking for Arabs, so they captured Arabs and sold them, just like someone catches a fish and sells it, he said. The detainee said he was seized by mafia operatives somewhere in Europe and sold to Americans because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, an Arab in a foreign country. The detainee who said he was a Saudi businessman claimed, the Pakistani police sold me for money to the Americans. This is part of a roundup of all foreigners and Arabs in that area of Pakistan near the Afghan border, he said, telling the tribunal he went to Pakistan in November 2001 to help Afghan refugees. The military appointed representative for one detainee, who said he was a Taliban fighter, said the prisoner told him he and his fellow fighters were tricked into surrendering. Their agreement was that they would give up their arms and return home, but the forces sold them to the U.S. for money. In March 2002, the Associated Press reported that Afghan intelligence offered rewards for the capture of Al-Qaeda fighters the day after a five-hour meeting with U.S. Special Forces. Intelligence officers refused to say if the two events were linked and if the United States was paying the offered reward of 150 million Afghanis, then equivalent to $4,000 a head. That day, leaflets and loudspeaker announcements promised the big prize to those who turned in Al-Qaeda fighters. Said one leaflet, "You can receive millions of dollars. This is enough to take care of your family, your village, your tribe for the rest of your life. Pay for livestock and doctors and school books and housing for all your people." Helicopters broadcast similar announcements over the Afghan mountains, enticing people to hand over the Arabs and feed your families for a lifetime, said a former Qatar justice minister and leader of a group of Arab lawyers representing nearly 100 detainees. And this story from the Washington Times. The director of Amnesty International USA dismissed the White House's criticism of his group's latest report on purported U.S. human rights abuses, saying officials were all too willing to applaud Amnesty when its target was Saddam Hussein. The Bush administration has regularly relied on Amnesty International when it pleases them, William F. Schultz, who runs the organization's 167-person staff, told the Washington Times. So if we are such a left-leaning group, why did Donald Rumsfeld rely upon our reports in the run-up to the Iraq War? And why is the administration more than happy to cite Amnesty reports on countries such as Cuba, China, and North Korea? Amnesty International's website states it is, quote, independent of any government, political ideology, economic interest, or religion. It does not support or oppose any government. Last week, Amnesty issued its annual report on human rights abuses. Mr. Schultz and Amnesty International's Secretary General Irene Kahn used especially tough language. Mr. Schultz labeled Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld and other top aides as architects of torture. Mrs. Kahn likened the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where more than 500 Taliban and Al-Qaeda suspects are held, to Soviet-style gulags where millions died under the rule of Joseph Stalin. Vice President Dick Cheney on Monday told CNN's Larry King, "I don't take Amnesty International seriously. Frankly, I was offended by it. I think the fact of the matter is the United States has done more to advance the cause of freedom, has liberated more people from tyranny over the course of the 20th century and up to the present day than any other nation in the history of the world." Of Mr. Cheney's criticisms, Mr. Schultz said, "He clearly does not take the Geneva Convention in international law seriously either." Mr. Schultz denied Amnesty International has a left-wing bias against the administration. "We are an equal opportunity offender, going after governments all over the world who infringe on basic human rights." This story from the Associated Press. Israel's equivalent of Walter Cronkite, a respected TV journalist who has delivered the main evening news since 1968, has stepped out from behind the shield of measured neutrality with an angry indictment of Israel's settlement policy and occupation of the Palestinians. Haim Yavin's five-part documentary, Part 1, was being broadcast Tuesday and prompted calls from settlers for its dismissal, but could also mark a watershed in how the nation views its four-decade rule over Palestinians. Yavin, 72 years old, has anchored the evening news on Israel's public TV channel since 1968, building an image as a dispassionate reporter, much as Cronkite did in the United States. A founder of Israel's public TV station, Yavin is known as Mr. TV and commands considerable respect. Rarely have settlers been portrayed as harshly by Israeli's mainstream media as in Yavin's documentary, filmed with his handheld video camera and interspersed with his commentary. Quote, "Since 1967, we have been brutal conquerors, occupiers, suppressing another people," Yavin comments in his first segment after listening to settlers insist God gave them these lands. Yavin's stand comes at a time of controversy over the settlements Israel built in the West Bank and Gaza Strip after capturing the lands in the 1967 Mideast War. Tom Segev, an Israeli author and social commentator, said Yavin's reputation could sway some Israelis. "He is Mr. Israel, the voice of Israel, the soul of Israel, and if he comes out with this, it means that apparently a lot of people feel the same," Segev said, "but I'm not sure if people will react." When Cronkite returned from a reporting trip to Vietnam and told his viewers in an editorial comment that the United States could not win the war, then-President Lyndon B. Johnson observed that if he had lost Cronkite, he had lost Middle America. Yavin said he was able to keep his view out of the many documentaries he made in the past, but when the latest round of fighting with the Palestinians broke out and Palestinian suffering increased, he decided to act. He said in a telephone interview Tuesday he did not believe that he had become more dovish, but Israelis had become more hawkish. "We have to go through a mental revolution," Yavin said. "The Palestinians are a people, and we have to share this land. We have to wake up from our dream." In this documentary, Yavin repeatedly shows Palestinians suffering at the hands of arrogant soldiers and settlers. In one scene, he filmed a crowded Israeli army roadblock showing sick women and crying children waiting for hours in the hot sun. Israelis set up the roadblocks at the outbreak of the current round of fighting in 2000. Saying they were needed to prevent Palestinian suicide bombers and gunmen from reaching Israel. At one point, Yavin shifted the camera toward the Israeli soldiers to ask why they weren't letting people through. "I look for danger in these people, and I can't find it," Yavin said in the film. Settlers were outraged over the documentary, which was broadcast by the private Channel 2 rather than by Yavin's station, Israeli TV. Israeli TV declined to air the documentary. Yavin said the decision was not politically motivated. Fewer than a dozen settlers held a demonstration outside the office of Israeli Broadcasting Authority, which oversees Israeli TV. And in the final story for the day, this was in the Associated Press. Tobacco companies did elaborate research on women to figure out how to hook them on smoking, even toying with the idea of chocolate-flavored cigarettes that would curb appetite, according to a new analysis. Researchers at Harvard University's School of Public Health said they examined more than 7 million documents, some dating back to 1969, others as recent as 2000, for new details about the industry's effort to lure more women smokers. Carrie Carpenter, the study's lead author, said company's research went far beyond a marketing or advertising campaign. They did so much research in such a sophisticated way, she said, women should know how far the tobacco industry went to exploit them. The report, published in the June issue of the journal Addiction, says tobacco companies looked for ways to modify the cigarettes to give women the illusion that they could puff their way into a better life. One of these documents, a 1987 internal report from Philip Morris, extolled the virtues of making a longer, slimmer cigarette that offered the false promise of a healthier product. Most smokers have little notion of their brand's tar and nicotine levels, the report states. Perception is more important than reality, and in this case, the perception is of reduced tobacco consumption. A Philip Morris spokesman declined to comment on the report, saying the company hasn't had a chance to fully review it. The Harvard researchers spent more than a year sifting through an online database of internal documents made public following the 1998 settlement between tobacco companies in 46 states. Carpenter said they found at least 320 documents that focused on women's smoking patterns, including a 1982 report from the British American Tobacco Company that said women buy cigarettes to help them cope with neuroticism. We can safely conclude that the strength of cigarettes that are purchased by women is related to their degree of neuroticism, the report stated. Other internal studies showed the companies explored adding appetite suppressants to cigarettes. In 1988, for instance, R.J. Reynolds' company proposed creating a cigarette with a unique flavor that decreases a smoker's appetite. Paul Bloom, a marketing professor in the business school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, noticed that cigarettes aren't the only sin product marketed specifically to women. For a long time, they just marketed beer to men. Then he discovered women would drink it too, Bloom said. Now binge drinking on campus is just as big of a problem with women as it is with men. Worldwide smoking rates among women are expected to increase 20% by 2025, driven by the growth of female markets in developing countries, while men's smoking rates are steadily declining, the Harvard report says. Jack Henningfield, a professor of behavioral biology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, said he hopes the report serves as a call to action for government officials to focus the anti-smoking efforts on women, particularly in developing countries. It's a time bomb, said Henningfield, director of the Innovators Combating Substance Abuse Program at Johns Hopkins. They've got to act now to prevent the time bomb from exploding. Carpenter said there was no evidence in the troves of documents that suggest tobacco companies have stopped targeting women. And that's the news. Like I need it.
so do I. So goodbye. The airline said today you better get out now. The airline said today you better get out now. You better get out now.
That was Pierce Woodward with Tell Me the News, another new one from him. Next, we go to hear selections from the opening speakers for the National Conference for Media Reform, which occurred in May 2005. A number of WSCA members attended the conference, and we heard it was great, so we'd like to share this with you.
I'm John Nichols from Free Press, and this is your National Conference for Media Reform. You have come from 50 states, every state in this union, from the District of Columbia, which still needs representation in our Congress, from Puerto Rico, from Canada, from Brazil, from China, from India, from Mexico, from Great Britain, Korea, Switzerland, Australia, and France. And you have all come because you believe, as the greatest political analyst of the 1960s, Curtis Mayfield, said, "People get ready. There's a train a-coming." You don't need no baggage. You just get on board. It is a train of justice. We have media justice in this room. It is a train of indie media. We have indie media in this room. It's a train of community radio stations from across this country. Community radio, public radio activists. This is a justice train. This is a freedom train, it's a democracy train, and it is taking us, rolling toward that promised land where media serves not corporate needs, but human needs. Where media treats us not as consumers to sell something to, but as citizens of a great democracy. Where our children are not carpet bombed with 20,000 commercials by the age of 5, but are educated and inspired to be the next generation of citizens. Where every voice, black and brown, gay and straight, left and right, immigrant and indigenous, is reflected in our newspapers, our television, and our radio. Where journalists refuse to be stenographers to power, where the lies and the liars who would send our children to distant lands to die are exposed before those wars begin. Where our media is as good and humane and responsible and honorable as the American people it is supposed to serve. Where we part the Red Sea of lies and push ourselves forward to that plane of truth where democracy and justice is not seen as something we have to beg for, but is something that is real in all of our lives. This is what brings us to St. Louis, Missouri. In the middle of America, beneath the great arch of exploration, to explore the new promise of this country. This is where a young man named Joseph Pulitzer, more than 100 years ago, started a newspaper called the Post-Dispatch. And when he started that newspaper, he had a set of principles that he talked about what media ought to be. 100 years ago, the North American Review asked him to say, you know, where should media fit into this whole process of a democratic experiment? Pulitzer said, "Our republic and its press will rise or fall together. An able, disinterested, public-spirited press with trained intelligence to know the right and the courage to cover the right can preserve the public virtue without which popular government is a sham and a mockery. A cynical, mercenary, demagogic press will produce in time a people as base as itself. The power to mold the future of the republic will be in the hands of the journalists of future generations." Joseph Pulitzer would be horrified by what our media has become and what it has done to the American people. We come to St. Louis, to Joseph Pulitzer's town, to say no more. No more do we make a lie of his promise of what he said that media ought to be. Josh Silver.
Thank you. You'll have to forgive me, my voice is going, so I'll do my best. Thanks so much for being here, everyone. It's such an honor to have this many folks come from so far. I think we have 8 countries here in addition to every state. Up to 10. You're sitting amongst an unprecedented network of regional, national, local groups and individuals working tirelessly for media reform. And the great news about this is that we are actually winning. So I'm here to tell you today about how we're winning, because that's one of the great untold stories that's happening in this country. Because surprise, surprise, the media, the U.S. media, doesn't report it. I know. Everyone, once you've recovered, we blocked the FCC's effort to make big media get even bigger. And it's because of everybody in this room that happened. And it's because all the people you work with back home. We forced Sinclair to stop airing electioneering as news. And it was all of you that did that. We forced the FCC to investigate payola pundits like Armstrong Williams, who took $250,000 from your money to promote the Department of Education policies. And we uncovered, thanks to good journalists who are out in this crowd, did the same, and we're integral to that effort. We forced Congress to last week require that government-funded fake news, covert propaganda, be disclosed, albeit for only 1 year, but it's an important start, and it was because of you. And there's some other quiet organizing happening in the sidelines that people don't know about, that it's crucial that not only we know about, but also that people across this country understand. Community internet, the effort to get the whole future of communications, which is going to be a digital pipe down the road in a few years, TV, internet, phone, all through a digital connection. Cable and telephone companies are working tirelessly to make it illegal for anybody but them to offer high-speed internet. This is the future of communications, and grassroots work by you in this room stopped legislation in West Virginia, Florida, Illinois, Indiana, where we pushed back this hostile legislation, and we have cases in Iowa, Nebraska, Texas, Oregon, Ohio, and Louisiana, where the cable and telephone companies are unable to move forward because of us. And cable franchise renewals, a crucial issue, the way that we get independent voices on the air, shows like Democracy Now!, more carriage for other shows that are independent and non-commercial. There has been great fights happening on the ground in states like Arizona, where we beat back hostile legislation that would have seriously hindered the public's ability to increase diversity on cable television. So we have 125 groups representing 20 million Americans who signed the Bill of Media Rights. We've seen a very loud and effective response to efforts by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the White House to inject partisan politics into our public broadcasting system. There's a lot of victories I'm leaving out. One of the plenaries that's going to happen this weekend is called The Fight of Our Lives. And this is not hyperbolic. We understand, we're here because we understand how bankrupt our media system really is. We understand that our democracy truly hangs in the balance. We understand that we're part of a movement that is growing at astonishing speed. People said the media reform movement could never come together, that it was too fractured, that all the different groups and different interests could not communicate or collaborate. I've worked on other issues, I've read about the others, and I'm here to tell you that the victories that we've had, the growing momentum, the excitement that you feel when you look around this room, that you can feel in this room, has proven the skeptics wrong. And we are a more unified and more organized movement than we ever have been before, and we've just begun. I also want to just make a note, just so that this doesn't get omitted from this weekend. I think it's really important. This is one of my pet issues that I hope people will think about when you go home. We really do need to support some of the other structural issues that are absolutely crucial to making this country better. We cannot forget about campaign finance reform. We cannot forget about redistricting and how we have to reinstall democracy into Congress. We cannot forget about election reform and the importance of fair elections. So here we are, and we're keenly aware of why we're here. We understand that the victories of the past years have happened amongst one of the most hostile political environments this country's ever seen. And we are just beginning. We are not going to rest until we build a media system that represents all people, that holds government accountable, that educates our children, that nourishes democracy, justice, and civil society, not just media corporations. So on behalf of Free Press staff, our volunteers, board members, countless people, too many to name, who made this event possible, I welcome you to St. Louis.
Our next speaker is someone well known to those who work on media reform on a day-to-day basis. He is the research director for the Consumer Federation of America. He has been foundational in generating some of the most important research that has helped us win court cases on media ownership, win court cases on internet access. He is a beacon of light for all of us working in Washington, D.C. On media policy issues, and please join me in welcoming Mark Cooper.
You can tell that I'm supposed to do the analysis part here, and hopefully I won't have too much a downer here because I tend to bring things up. But I only had 10 minutes, and to find a way to tie together the intellectual part and the heart part, and so I figured I would focus on four simple reasons why the momentum for the media reform movement will in fact reclaim the First Amendment for the people in the 21st century. Four little reasons. Law, history, technology, and economics. The law is on our side. And I want you to recall a movie entitled Four Weddings and a Funeral, because in fact, free speech in the 21st century is being decided by four court cases and a legislative Donnybrook. The four court cases you've heard are Prometheus, which stopped the broadcasters from gutting the media ownership limits. The Brand X case, which turned back the efforts of the cable companies to close the telecommunications network and operate it as a private system. The broadcast flag case just last week, which put the kibosh on the effort of the FCC and Hollywood to control TVs, PCs, and VCRs. And finally, the Grokster case, in which the court refused to shut down file sharing. These four cases were celebrations of freedom of expression and fair use. And the reason the law is still on our side is history. Free speech and fair use are deeply embedded in American democracy. Try as the industry might, they have been unable to get it out because it's ingrained in our DNA. The roads over which Paul Revere traveled to spread the word that the British were coming were available on a non-discriminatory basis under British common law, like the community wireless networks we are building all across this country. The committees of correspondence that awaited his alarm were acts of civil disobedience against commercial monopolists that took place in the cellars and the forests of a continent the British could not control, like the blogs and the websites of cyberspace today. Under our Constitution, ideas are born free, which was a radical concept, and the airwaves belong to the public. Try as they might, they have not been able to get rid of that. Throughout the 19th century, as Bob McChesney has taught us, the penny press and postal subsidies spread information to the populace. And at the end of the 19th century, when the railroads and the telephone companies tried to shut down the new means of commerce and communications, the American people rose up in rebellion in the populist and progressive movements and said no, especially here in the Middle West. So the digital revolution is unsettling the media landscape again. The techies and stock analysts call it convergence. But what is really happening here is dramatic democratization of the means of communication in our society. Computers, communication over the internet, the declining cost of digital production have transformed consumers into producers, listeners into speakers. We are putting the mass in the mass media for the first time in our history. And that is a revolution that is just beginning and will not be turned back. Perhaps the most clear example of that, and one that really shows us the power, is the growth of Wi-Fi networks. You all use them all the time, and they have given rise to our community internet movement. Here we have the best demonstration that not only do the airwaves belong to the people, but they are best managed as a commons, where people are allowed to use the space without being fettered by licenses or excluded by private property. This is our space, and we're using it, and we need to expand it. Whenever powerful and interests lose their technological and economic edge, they turn to the use of force, and that is what is happening today. The desperation is evident in 10,000 lawsuits filed without due process against music file sharers, in the failure of the broadcasters to distribute video programming, digital programming, in the effort of the cable companies to close their networks, in the effort of the telephone companies to prevent cities from paving the streets of the information age by building community wireless networks. So Hollywood, the record companies, the broadcasters, the cable companies, the telcos, lost in court because of history and law. They will go to Congress, and they will have a vehicle. 10 years ago, Congress gave the broadcasters more spectrum for free, but the networks couldn't figure out how to use it. Everybody wants the old stuff back. The Congress wants to sell it to buy more bombs, and they are going to try and push that legislation through. That is our legislative Donnybrook. So now why am I still confident, optimistic, that we will prevail? You are the reason. You are the wedding celebration of democracy. You will not let them do that to us. The stakes are very different. In 1996, it was the cable companies versus the broadcasters, the long-distance companies versus the local companies, the wireless companies versus the wireline companies. That is not the case today. Today, the issue is free speech and fair use. Today, they want to steal our digital future, and we will not let them do that. There was no conference like this in 1995. While they were in their back rooms divvying up the media landscape. There were no technologies of democracy for organizing and funding a people's movement. No bloggers, no meetups. There was no sense of outrage about the manipulation of the media and the masses. There is today. The Communications Act of 2006 will not be written behind closed doors. John F. Kennedy... John F. Kennedy said it well. The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who remain neutral during times of moral crisis. Fewer and fewer Americans are willing to remain neutral. More and more Americans understand that this is a time of moral crisis, brought about in large measure by the failure of our media to provide their function in our society. Fewer and fewer Americans trust the media. That is why they are taking the job into their own hands. You have the historical tradition. You have the technologies of democracy. You have an aroused people. This is a tough revolution. But we will win. We will win not only in stopping the campaign to steal our digital future, but in using the tools of expression, participation, involvement that we develop to drive American democracy to a higher level. That is why I'm optimistic that the movement is gaining momentum. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark. This is a heterogeneous movement. We've all talked about that. We see it among us here. We'll see it throughout this weekend. It takes place in Washington, D.C., with activists and organizers and lobbyists there, and scholars and researchers. It takes place all across the country. But there's no doubt, if you understand the logic of this movement, the entire basis of success is putting bottom-up heat from around the country on those above us. It's the only way we can win in this movement. It's the source of all the power we have. All the success we can get in Washington ultimately comes from our ability to arouse people across this country, organize in communities across this country. We have next as our speaker one of the people who's doing that hard work in communities around this country, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, many of them attending this conference. Malkia Cyril is the director of the Youth Media Council, a Bay Area-based youth organizing, capacity building, and media watchdog organization dedicated to developing youth-led strategies for media justice. I've gotten to know her over the last few years as this movement's taken off, and it is my great honor to welcome her to speak to you right now.
I mean, are we winning? I mean, are we winning? So I would be remiss if I didn't start in true activist tradition. When I say media, you say justice. Media?
Justice.
Media?
Justice.
When I say we want, you say justice. We want?
Justice.
We want?
Justice.
See, I am privileged today to be up here with some great minds, and I'm privileged today to be here with all of you. Folks from organizations like Reclaim the Media, Prometheus Radio, Media Alliance, Third World Majority, Media Tank, and the Applied Research Center, and hundreds of others teach me every day that we are winning. We can win. But there continue to be questions about who we are, and I hope to answer some of those questions today. Popular funk musician George Clinton said, and I paraphrase, whoever controls the news determines our destiny. Most of us agree that a fight to determine the destiny of this country is rooted in part in who owns the media and who makes the rules. The question for some of us is, how do we surface the historical context of communications and shift the current power relations of the media system? The answer involves, in part, dispelling certain myths about a free press, developing a relevant framework for media reform, and using that reform as a bridge toward justice and real structural change. Let me tell you a little bit about myself, because I like to get personal. I hope there's not too much information. I was born in New York into a childhood marked by the language of super predators and welfare moms 31 years ago. Lies about a steadily growing crime rate and a consistent invisibility about the relationship between the social conditions of my community and the policy decisions of this nation's leaders was kind of the media that I inhaled every day. This distorted and biased media content told the public a story about the content of my character, a story that built public acceptance for a political war on crime and drugs that led to the incarceration and death of millions, including many I knew and loved. For many of us, media reform is more than a fight for our media, it is a fight for our lives. As we've already heard, we face today a Bush-led war on the world with hundreds of thousands of deaths and even more dangerous times ahead. Our media system represents a crisis of democracy for the vast majority of the population. Our communication rights are one of the many civil rights being rolled back, but not without a fight. From state to state, communities refuse to give up their right to equal media access, fair, accurate, and balanced content, and the power to own and control media infrastructure. From alternative media and public television to cable access, ethnic press, and low-power FM, marginalized communities require a movement that demands telecommunications policies in our interests. When we speak of media reform, the intentions of the quote-unquote framers and constitutional interpretations offer incomplete answers to the questions, what is a free press and how is it guaranteed? We've heard that Jefferson and Madison understood the importance of an astute press in creating the foundation for a strong democracy and protection against elite rule. What remains both invisible and undeniable in the debate about U.S. media is the colonial context of its birth. As the founding fathers were documenting their concept of a free press, they were also building a slaveholding capitalist economy and a white nationalist politic that would entrench media policies and practices for centuries to come. Our current media system reproduces and maintains the colonial power relationships of its beginnings. Understanding the role media plays in creating and perpetuating structural racism and class oppression is not a secondary issue. It is central to building an effective and relevant movement for media reform that fundamentally transforms the U.S. system of communications. By adopting race, class, and gendered lens to examine issues of media content, access, and infrastructure, we can dispel three dangerous myths. The first myth is that the U.S. media used to be more democratic and has become less so over time. The fact is, the U.S. media was born of colonial conquest and imperial intrusion, calling the democratic foundations of this press into direct question. For people of color, women, queer people, and young folks, there has never been a free press, and without racial, economic, and gender justice, there never will be. The second myth is that communication rights are inherently individual civil rights guaranteed by citizenship. But what of the millions of undocumented people forced by economic and political conditions to emigrate to this country? What of the millions of incarcerated men, women, and children whose citizenship rights are severed by confinement? What of the black, brown, female, queer, and young people whose basic civil rights require ongoing movements to secure and even then are always in question? Where there is no real mechanism to guarantee civil rights, citizenship offers no protection or guarantee of communication rights. The The third and final myth we must dismantle is that we can achieve a free press without also working to end racism, sexism, and class oppression. Nothing could be further from the truth. Before the current trends of consolidation, re-regulation in the corporate interest, and corporate control, the media was simultaneously a tool for civic engagement and a threat to the life and liberty of marginalized communities, and remains so today. In a free market society organized by class, race, and gender, no press can be truly free unless the people who use it and are impacted by it are also free. If we want to bring about real change, the media reform movement must adopt a movement-building analysis, change model, and vision that centers racial, economic, and gender justice. Media justice is a framework for media policy change that seeks to expose structural racism and class oppression in our media system, use local organizing campaigns to root our victories, develop marginalized communities as media activists and leaders, and build an expansive movement for communication rights. We want accountability, alternatives, and a media reform movement that spins on an axis of self-determination and strategic alliance. As a member of the growing media justice movement, we at the Youth Media Council believe there are 5 strategic steps we can take to build an effective movement for media justice. 1, connect media policy to racial justice. 2, use content battles, access fights, and media accountability campaigns to engage new constituencies in the fight for progressive media policy. 3, organize and coordinate from the ground up. 4, use key political moments as strategic opportunities to advance our media policy agenda. Like many of you, we are working to build infrastructure, base, and leaders at the local level to challenge the Bush administration's imminent attack on the 1996 Telecommunications Act. In partnership with Media Alliance and others, we will use the upcoming broadcast license renewal process to challenge corporate control of our airwaves, increase accountability on local radio stations, confront structural racism in the licensing process, and lay the foundation for national opposition to Bush's plan. It is our turn now. It is our time. Marginalized communities care about media reform because our lives and our freedom are at stake. We care because from hip-hop to advertising, media corporations stereotype and exploit the culture of youth and people of color for profit, while those same corporations use our families to create and assemble the technology that makes them rich. We care because our communities remain producers and consumers of a media system over which they have little to no control. But powerlessness is another dangerous myth we must dismantle. Together, we have the combined strategy and skill to dismantle and rebuild this media system. Where the U.S. has used our media to export racism, sell war, and destructively declare itself a singular superpower, the problem of the U.S. media is a problem for the entire world. If I didn't say it before, let me say it now. Victory is imminent. In fact, it is everywhere. From the accountability campaign against Hot 97 in New York, to the Miami-based Immokalee Workers Fight for Low Power FM. Marginalized communities are here as stakeholders, as organizers, and as visionaries. A truly free press is our right, and we're damn sure gonna fight for it. Thank you.
They were digging a new foundation in Manhattan, and they discovered a slave cemetery there. May their souls rest easy now that lynching is frowned upon. We've moved on to the electric chair. And I wonder who's gonna be president, Tweedledum or Tweedledummer? And who's gonna have the big blockbuster box office this summer? How about we put up a wall between the houses and the highway, and then you can go your way and I can go my way. Republicans agree with all the radios. And I keep hearing that same damn song everywhere I go. Maybe I should put a bucket over my head and a marshmallow in each ear and stumble around for another dum-dum week for another humdrum hit song to appear. People used to make records, as in a record of an event. The event of people playing music in a room. Now everything is cross-marketing. It's about sunglasses and shoes or guns and drugs, you choose. We got it rehashed, we got it half. We're digging up all the graves and we're spitting on the past. And we can choose between the colors of the lipstick on the whores, cause we know the difference between the font of 20% more and the font of teriyaki. You tell me, how does it make you feel? You tell me what's real. And they say that alcoholics are always alcoholics, even when they're dry as my lips for years. Even when they're stranded on a small desert island with no place in 2,000 miles to buy beer. And I wonder, is he different? Is he different? Has he changed what he's about? Or is he just a liar with nothing to lie about? Am I headed for the same brick wall? Is there anything I can do about anything at all except go back to that corner in Manhattan and dig deeper this time? Down beneath the impossible pain of our history, beneath unknown bones, beneath the bedrock of the mystery, beneath the sewage system and the path train, beneath the cobblestones and the water main, beneath the traffic of friendships and street deals, beneath the screeching of kamikaze cab wheels, beneath everything I can think of to think about, beneath all, get out, beneath the good and the kind and the stupid and the cruel, there's a fire that's just waiting for fuel. There's a fire 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 just waiting for fuel.